Hi, I'm Ingrid Kohler.
And I'm Jonathan Kerr-West.
And welcome to LGIU Fortnightly.
Ingrid, hi. It's great to be back.
I know. 2 weeks in a row.
I know. It's very exciting. It feels like just moments ago that we last recorded this, actually, because it's been a really, really busy couple of weeks, hasn't it?
It really has. And we've been putting out a lot of stuff. We've been sharing lots of information, running events.
Loads of events, which some of which we'll tell you about a bit later. Churning out briefings, excellent briefings on all aspects of, you know, how COVID-19 is affecting local government, how local government is thinking about recovery, but also other issues, whether that's social mobility or housing and planning, because the world, you know, all those things keep going at the same time as the pandemic. So huge amounts of material that you can see if you're an LGIU member, you can access on our website, trying to help you navigate these confusing and uncertain times. And it's just going to get busier. Loads of stuff coming up. We've got the Councillor Awards launched this week. Big moment for us. This week, we should have been on the terrace of the House of Commons for the all-party parliamentary group for local government summer reception, which we organise every year. We've been doing that for 15 years now.
Wow.
Yeah. A long time. And it's, you know, it's normally, it's a great event. I've only been going for 10 years, but in that time, it's only rained twice. You know, we always nearly always have sunshine. We get the great and the good from local government, you know, people that we've interacted with at LGIU, our members, people with an interest in local government. We get parliamentarians there. Obviously, we've always been lucky to have the Secretary of State for Communities and Local Government come and give a speech to express his or her, but nearly always his, appreciation for local government and the work that people do. And it's a really nice, I'm going to say friendly, it's a non-partisan, it's a kind of celebration and recognition of all the things that local government does. And it's a really great event, but we didn't do it this year.
No.
For obvious reasons. And in fact, if there is one place, I have to say, it's lovely being on the House of Commons terrace, but if there is one place that you wouldn't want to bring a large number of people in these times, it's that slightly humid tent that they have on the Gillespie. It's like the worst place you can imagine in the current circumstances.
And copious amounts of House of Commons white or red, which can lower your inhibitions and safety procedures as the night progresses.
House of Commons house wine is bad for the health in all sorts of ways, and indeed the palate. But apart from that, it's a great event. So we didn't do it, but we took the time to spend a little while on Twitter celebrating past events, and it's kind of cool actually. So if you go to the LGIU Twitter feed, you'll see, you know, pictures of, you know, Eric Pickles, Greg Clark, Sajid Javid, James Brokenshire all launching LGIU reports, Rishi Sunak a couple of years ago launching the scorecard of our local finance task force, and laughing uproariously at something I'm saying to him. I have no idea what.
I have my suspicions.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you don't see many pictures of Rishi laughing these days. But how times have changed. Yeah, the halcyon days of 2018.
When there was always just no money to worry about.
Quite. So we've been kind of indulging in a little trip down memory lane, looking at some of those pictures. But look, seriously, I think what's interesting in that, actually, is that it reminded me of, you know, of all the things we've done, but also how much outstanding business there is. So one that really struck me, for example, was Eric Pickles in 2012 holding up a copy of a report we did with the APPG, with the local government APPG, when it was chaired by Heather Wheeler, looking at social care and the funding of social care. And I was just struggling. Yeah, that was 8 years ago. And actually, we've really progressed this very little since then. Yeah, and then there's a report that, you know, him in 2013 with a report we did on, you know, personal funding, you know, for for self-funding for social care. And again, we've, in policy terms, we've progressed that very little. Now, if you go back to 2012, at the time we did that report, the official position, the minister at the time, Paul Burstow, was saying there is no funding gap in social care. So
he didn't stick to that line.
No, he didn't. He didn't. As soon as he left government, he said he has a huge funding gap. But you know, so in a sense, we've moved forward and the problem is more recognised. And you know, I'd like to think that report was part of exposing that. But what to do about it remains, you know, we await that green paper as we have done for the last 3 years. So it sort of brings you up short, really, thinking, well, actually, we haven't really moved on some of these core issues for local government. We've not moved that far in the best part of a decade.
And now is the time to really look at some of those things again. But before we go on to the perilous state of social care and the no money thing, there is also another celebration that we do in our calendar of annual events.
Sure. Yes. So the other big celebration of local government we have is in the winter. It's the Councillor Awards, now in their 11th year, and nominations opened this week. So that's the other big bit of news here at LJU. Those nominations are open. So, you know, as many listeners will be aware, the Council Awards, which we run in conjunction with CCLA, Charities, Churches and Local Authorities Investment Fund, who have sponsored it since it started 11 years ago. These are the only awards that celebrate the role of councillors as councillors, as individual councillors. So, you know, there's lots of other things that celebrate the achievements of councils corporately. But there's nothing else that really spotlights and celebrates those individual people who make such a huge contribution to their communities across the country. So, you know, we've been doing that for a decade now. It gets bigger and bigger every year. We get more and more nominations every year. Last year, we had a record number of nominations. We hope to surpass that. The problem with getting a record number is that every year you set yourself a tougher target.
Yeah, also we have to read them all.
No, but reading them is great. Because
it is usually great. There's some amazing stories in them.
Yeah, as I said many times before, you know, reading them is a real tonic in a world that is often, you know, where we see and spend a lot of time talking about problems, talking about bad news. You know, reading those nominations for the Council Awards is a tonic. It's the complete opposite. It's like, wow, look at these amazing things that people are doing with, you know, for no pay, for little recognition, for precious little thanks, people doing amazing jobs for their communities. So as always, we want to celebrate that. But as always, we need your help, because it can't happen if people don't nominate councillors for the awards. So I think it's a fair bet that everyone listening to this podcast, going out on a limb here, nearly everyone listening to this podcast will know a councillor that they think deserves recognition. If you do, please, please, please go to www.lgiu.org and nominate them. There's a very simple nomination form. You can find it. It's very prominent on our website. It's really important this year, I think, more than ever, that we recognize that throughout this really difficult period that we've been living through, those elected representatives have been doing an amazing job for their communities. So we really want to celebrate that. So please do get your nominations in. And we've got a couple of new categories this year in Scotland and in England, because we run the awards in both countries. One is specifically to recognize, you know, leadership this year with our COVID-19 Hero Award, because I think it's only right that we celebrate those councillors who have played such a crucial role in helping their residents through this period, where people, you know, have had all the challenges posed by social distancing, by isolation, by disruption to their lives, by economic hardship. And we know that councillors around the country have played a really, really, really important role in helping people to to manage those challenges, and we want to celebrate that. And the other new award we're introducing this year.
This one's really different. This one's different.
Well, tell us about it.
Well, I mean, it is, as you said, this is about recognizing individual counselors. But honestly, there's a style of leadership that's often overlooked everywhere, and that's that collaborative teamwork style of leadership. And we've known this has been a gap for a while, but we've created a new category for this. So it's the collaborative leaders, recognizing those people who do play well with others and get the job done for their communities. So this is about groups of counselors who have worked effectively together, but also counselors who are working with their external partners as well. So LEPs and local businesses and NGOs or other similar groups. And so we know that the real innovation and transformation comes from that kind of bouncing ideas off of each other and working together and bringing different skills and expertise. So we wanted to recognize that. And you know, you can actually, unlike all the other awards, you can actually nominate yourself for this one, because you're not just nominating yourself, you're nominating your whole group. So don't be shy.
Yes, please do get over to our website, nominate counselors you know, nominate yourself if you are part of a council team that you think is doing a great job. We really want to hear from you. Nominations are open through until September, and there will be a big awards event in November, but unlike most years, that won't be a physical event. We won't be bringing people together in person, which is a shame, but I think we've taken the view that even by November, it's unlikely to be sensible to have a gathering of nearly 200 people. So we're going to make a virtue of it and do it brilliantly online. So we'll be having a whole week, and the week commencing the 23rd of November, a whole week of celebration of councillors and local democracy, with the events broadcast, and we'll have, you know, video clips of some of the nominated councillors. We'll have interviews. We'll have all sorts of exciting stuff. And watch this space for more to come on that. So we're going to do it. We're going to do it online, but we're going to do it innovatively and interestingly and inventively, and it will be. I'm not going to say it's going to be even better than a physical event, but it's going to be just as good in a different way. Less canapes. Maybe people can have canapes at home as they watch.
Maybe we'll
less
share
wine
a
and canapes. but more. I think more insight into the nominated councillors, the shortlisted councillors, and particularly the winners. So more to come on that. But do watch this space, and please do make a nomination. Right, Ingrid, what else have we been up to?
Oh my gosh. So by the time this comes out, we'll have facilitated a big online meeting of the local government all-party parliamentary group, the APPG.
They didn't have their reception, but they are going to have a meeting.
We're going to do the business, yeah. So obviously it'll be too late, but we will share what we can from that. But we also had another big event last week. We hosted a great event. You hosted it. I actually was doing something else. But a great event on homelessness with Dame Louise Casey as our kind of feature speaker. And we've packaged up a new bundle of LGIU content on homelessness, including briefings, a blog from Phil Willis, who was also speaking, former Minister of State, and as well as other resources on international perspectives on how local government around the world have been trying to tackle homelessness. So we're going to hear a little bit from Dame Louise, but the whole thing, you can watch the whole thing on the website.
Thanks very much, Jonathan, and good afternoon, everybody. Look, first of all, the thing to say is I agreed to do a review, Jonathan's correct, into rough sleeping and the causes of rough sleeping. And I was going to start that after Easter, I think. And then in the meantime, COVID-19 came. The first thing I wanted to say, Jonathan, is I think that local government has just played an absolute blinder in terms of what's happened so far in relation to rough sleeping in particular, for me anyway, as my interest in this. And like with many things in my life, in terms of working for government, that actually working in partnership, working with, working through, working alongside colleagues in local government on the Troubled Families Programme, on the Antisocial Behaviour one, and now back just looking at COVID-19 and rough sleeping, I think just the extraordinary work and commitment above and beyond anything that anybody could have rightly expected by many, many, many colleagues in local government has been quite extraordinary. And I do hope at some point in the future that can be truly recognised. I think it's no secret to colleagues on the call that I have often felt that the role of local government as a kind of the main player in any community for getting something done and knitting together our communities, I think it's a much misunderstood and undervalued part of the public sector, which meant that when austerity came, it was an easy target, really. Whereas actually cutting things like frontline police officers and frontline health workers is much more difficult for governments of any political persuasion to do. Whereas actually the people that take our bins away, the people that look after our old people, the people that protect our children, the people that actually have literally housed 15,000 people, not quite overnight, but not far off that, in terms of the early work on COVID-19. That's all down to local government and local government officers. Yes, working in partnership with others, but the leadership was important. So first stage was to essentially try and make sure we got everyone in. That was on the basis of advice from Jonathan Van Tam, the Deputy Chief Medical Officer, and more latterly with Jenny, his oppo, and that they were really clear. I rang them on Friday night, right at the very beginning, and said, I'm kind of worried about communal night shelters for the spread. What about people on the streets? Like, how urgent? And he said, really clearly, Louise, you've got to get them off the street. Not only are rough sleepers sort of aged beyond their age by an average of 10 to 15 years, they are older physically and mentally than the housed population, but also they are obviously so incredibly vulnerable with pre-existing conditions and things like drug, alcohol and mental health. So job one was getting everyone in. I think the local government did it really effectively. I think that now job two, which people have already started, and now we've got the money to make sure people are able to get on and do this properly, is to make sure that we don't just use the next tranche of money that's come through, the 105. And this is where, though I can't back any specific scheme, and Phil and Maxine know that, nevertheless, the territory that this discussion is in is the right territory, which is how can we take the money that we've got and as best we can use that for the longer term solutions, so that we try and use this moment of crisis and turn it into something that has more longitude attached to it.
So really interesting how, you know, and will be unsurprising to people, I think, that, you know, Dame Louise Casey really kind of centering the role of local government in tackling homelessness. And I think for me, what was interesting about the, you know, her speech, you know, bits of which you heard there, and the discussion afterwards was, you know, a recognition that the local government has done an incredible job getting people off the streets in the first stages of this pandemic. A lot of discussion about what we need to do moving forward and how we need sort of funding and the sort of certainty over the scheduling of funding to embed that, but that we also, everyone agreeing that we need to see, and this was a key recommendation or a key focus of the commission that we ran on homelessness last year, we need to shift this upstream. So of course we need to tackle rough sleeping, but rough sleeping is both the tip of the iceberg and the end of a process. you know, it's where people end up. We need to be intervening much earlier to prevent people getting anywhere near that level of home and that rough sleeping. You know, most homeless people are in temporary accommodation, insecure accommodation, couch surfing, sofa surfing, you know, staying with friends, you know, whatever. And we need to get ahead of that. And, you know, and as we saw last year in the work we did, that means, you know, better use of data. It means reforms to the private rental sector. It means a sort of overall strategy that we can plug into across government and across the country to try and make those early interventions. And, you know, that's not the focus. You know, Dame Louise Casey was very clear about this. That's not the focus of the task force that she's currently running, but that is where we need to end up. So it was a really interesting discussion. And then Phil Woolis, who's a former Minister of State back under the Labour government, is now involved with something called the 2020 Initiative, which is a new way of investing in social housing for local government, and a way of trying to build up that housing stock, the available housing stock, that can help us, you know, end homelessness. So a really, really interesting discussion, and, you know, very much COVID related, but also an issue that, you know, that was really pressing anyway. And I think, you know, one of the interesting things that we're seeing now is as we shift into, you know, although we're, you know, we're doing a lot of work on what we call post-COVID councils, and of course it's not post-COVID, it's the next phase, you know, the next phase of the pandemic, but we're shifting a bit now, like so many people are, like lots of local government is, going from that kind of emergency response to reflection, to a sort of thoughtful recovery. Yeah, we've published new collections on COVID-19 and the economy. We're still expanding on our post-COVID councils work. You're on our website, you know, you must check out the growing collection of resources we've got around sustainable futures, which is one of the pillars of our post-COVID councils framework. The next pillar where you're going to see a really big surge of activity is in place and community, which we will be launching towards the beginning of August. And we're running member events on both those issues that you can sign up to on the website. But what's interesting for me, I think, is how much of that conversation is about, you know, these are not about, these recovery issues are not issues that have been created by the pandemic. They're issues and fault lines and divergences and discrepancies that were there anyway, that have just been blown up by the current situation, that have been magnified or amplified by the situation we're going through now. So, yeah, Ingrid, for example, you're going to be leading the work on our pillar on trust and governance, and you're doing some thinking about that. But that of course is another example of something that was there anyway. There were huge problems, huge numbers of people losing faith in our democratic institutions pre-pandemic. Where do we go from here?
Yeah. So as listeners will know if they've heard any episodes of this podcast, I love nothing more than a local election. But we've already had a look at the idea of democracy deferred and how the pandemic is amplifying some of the issues around elections, around people's engagement with democracy. But of course, trust and governance isn't just about elections. It's about relationships between citizen and state and residents and communities with their local governments. That trusting relationship is built around truthfulness. It's certainly one of the pillars. And one of the things that we've seen that's been amplified, maybe it's just starting to come to people's attention in a real kind of way, is bad information, the rise of misinformation and disinformation. There are super spreaders out there who are spreading bad information about COVID-19, encouraging risky behaviors, diminishing the impact. Just as we were starting to lock down, before we actually locked down, I spoke with Melanie Hampton. She's Wandsworth cabinet member with responsibility for public health. And we had a long chat with her about the impact of misinformation on public health with regards to measles. So we've seen this happening, but it's only getting worse. And I'm sure, you know, we've all seen stuff around this, where bad information is being shared on social media platforms, but it has a real life and death impact that I think people are now starting to realize. And it has a similar negative impact on that relationship that we have with our elected leaders and with other community leaders. And so this is one of the themes that we're going to be exploring in the trust and governance pillar. To start doing some of that, I spoke with Daniel Mikhailov of Wellcome Data Labs about the impact of false and distorted information and how councils and local politicians can actually change the way that they communicate in this environment to get the good messages through.
I'm Daniel Mikhailov. I am an expert in sociology of technology, with a particular emphasis on how the academic system and researchers, scientists, experts are disrupted, challenged by technological change. That's the area of interest for me. In my day job, I work for the Wellcome Trust, one of the world's biggest philanthropies who funds scientific research in health and life sciences. And my job there is head of Wellcome Data Labs, so looking at data analysis in support of what Wellcome does.
Excellent. Okay. So we had a chat before about misinformation. We're living in a time when we're all kind of scouring the internet for information about a life-threatening disease that we don't know much about or think we don't know much about, and seeing a lot of varying kinds of information from different sources, everything from case counts and R rates to I saw on Facebook, a friend of mine actually shared something about like gargling with salt water to clear the virus from your throat to prevent yourself from getting COVID. How is somebody who isn't, you know, an epidemiologist supposed to navigate this kind of situation?
No, it's a great question. It's first of all, obviously, a difficult and challenging time for everyone. You know, nothing like this has happened in any of our lifetimes at this scale. So that's, I guess, the first thing to be said. And yet people are really challenged by understanding what's happening and which advice to listen to. And the simple answer would be just listen to your doctors, listen to the public health authorities who are trying to give out a clear message about what we should do to help fight against the pandemic. The less easy answer, of course, is we often filter these things through intermediaries, technology platforms like Twitter or Facebook. And there are lots of competing messages on those platforms. And often our, you know, nearest and dearest, our friends, our family will send us links to things. And that is difficult because obviously there we have, in addition, the emotional bonds to our friends and family. So we are predisposed to trust them. That adds another complication. So you have a time of uncertainty for everyone. You have technology, which is fast moving and, you know, an oversupply of information. And you have often emotional bonds with people who share information where we're predisposed to trust. And our instinct is to trust what our family tells us. And often it is our, you know, mother, brother, friend who sends us the link to something like what you mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, fortunately, with this friend, I know she's full of it. So it was an easy one to discount. I don't think she listens to this podcast, so I'm good. But she's very nice, I have to say. But what you've mentioned about listening to your public health authorities instead of to your random, slightly full of it friend or family member. But those, you know, I have an emotional attachment to local government because this is my career. So it's easy for me to listen to a public health authority and have some kind of connection to that. But for other people, that's not going to be the case. So how can public health authorities, local leaders, develop that same kind of emotional resonance so that those messages become a bit more powerful, or get close to it anyway?
So there are things that can be done. There are simple, techniques of communicating on different channels that public health authorities, local governments, other experts were trying to, if you like, get the information out to the public about what to do, can use. And often these vary platform to platform. But before kind of getting into the tactics of communication, the most important number one thing is to both gain and maintain public trust, to be trustworthy. That underpins everything else. So it is therefore as important not to be caught giving out inaccuracies yourselves, for example, for expedient reasons or political reasons, because that undermines trust. Having just doing it once undermines trust for all kind of future communication for a long time. It's hard to regain it. So I think trustworthiness is number one, building that connection with the public. In a way, local governments, I think, often have a head start to national bodies because, you know, in a local setting, you know your leaders of your council better than you would do, you know, your political leaders somewhere in the centre in faraway London. But that's the first thing I would say. Then in terms of tactics, then you need to understand what platform you want to communicate on, and they have different features. Twitter, for example, is, you know, famous for the shortness of its message, the speed in which communication changes. That has within it certain problems and challenges for communication. So because the messages are short, you need to condense what you're trying to portray. You can't get into the detail. That, of course, has the potential to mislead because you are summarizing something that is often difficult. A simple guidance often issued by communication professionals to experts who communicate on Twitter is don't use Twitter as the only means. So you might use Twitter to connect, but then have a link to something, to another medium, which allows a full explanation. If you're trying to get across something which is, you know, difficult, complicated, and it's important to get it right. So you might, for example, have, you know, a talking head video explaining your message and link it from Twitter. It's a kind of simple tactic.
I don't know if you've seen the Doncaster Twitter communications that have gone out, but they're quite amazing, where they've actually told a series of stories. They've tried to be quite personalizing. They've done it on Twitter with threads. But I think the famous one, and their first one was the kind of the story of the exploding whale and why we need to think through important public health decisions. And they sort of established both their authority and their trustworthiness in one go, which allowed them to do the kind of short messages quite in between these kind of storied pieces quite nicely.
That sounds like a perfect example of how to communicate well. It's about storytelling, narrative. So those kind of skills are really important and kind of making sure you do the right thing for the right medium platform you communicate on.
What is the kind of scale of misinformation and disinformation that we've been looking at in the public realm?
It's enormous. It's a big problem because of the billions and billions of messages going around across platforms every single day. The volume of information is very high. We also know from prior research that often information shared with an emotional content is more viral, so to speak, i.e. more likely to be liked and forwarded, clicked on. So there is not only the volume to deal with and the speed at which it comes. There's also the fact that there's always a pressure, if you like, to increase the emotional contact content of it in order for your messages to cut through. And that means messages which are more extreme tend to do better. So there is always that kind of escalation on social media.
And how can councils or local authorities, you know, in our case, say we're using the example of public health, but it comes across with all kinds of like local development, et cetera. How can they identify if there is a campaign of disinformation or a general kind of atmosphere of misinformation? How can they identify that and deal with that?
Well, the first thing to do is to understand what we mean by misinformation, disinformation. There's a range of different things happening at the same time. There are legitimate actors, so citizen groups who are trying to communicate to their elected representatives, be it on the council or national governments, and they have, you know, a full right to do this, be it's part of the kind of the social realm, something we should encourage. So there is communication by non-experts, which is valid and important. Sometimes that communication is wrong, factually. None of us are experts in everything. Experts themselves often get things wrong. So I think we need to distinguish kind of well-intentioned communication, which is sometimes wrong on social media, from then another group would be, I guess, a set of individuals who are maybe inadvertently, but are consistently pushing a message which is known to be wrong, has been disproven, but they persist in doing it. So I would describe that second group as more the misinformation we talk about, whether it's about vaccines or denying climate change or, you know, pushing the conspiracy theories around the COVID-19 pandemic. And then I guess there's another group, which is more disinformation, where you have almost strategic use of false information online in order to achieve a particular goal, whether that's a political goal or an economic goal. So you're pushing a product, trying to sell a product which has no effect. So number one, distinguish what we're talking about. Once you understand the complexity of the landscape and you understand who you're dealing with, then it's possible to, if you like, create the right tactics. So in the first case, where you're dealing with legitimate citizens, I've had experience from a number of kind of previous examples in my career where you need to try to engage openly with citizens online, whatever channel it is, Facebook, so, Twitter, etc. You need to make sure your own messages are correct to the initial point of maintaining trust, and you need to be respectful, but nonetheless get the facts out there in whatever way. Often, I can give you a couple of examples from if you're interested, but often people get things wrong by getting too much into detail. So I'll give you one example. When I was working for English Heritage in a prior role in their kind of new media part of the communications team, there was a case where a group, a local heritage group, history group, was concerned to preserve a particular historic building, was engaging with English Heritage, and they're the national body that protects historic buildings, campaigning, if you like, to get them to list a particular building, to protect it from development. So a local authority in that case was trying to develop a building, and the local heritage group was campaigning to protect it. And in that communication, if you kind of analyze it, there was you know, good intent, but there was also some misinformation about how the planning process worked and the listing process worked. And there was a definite kind of tactic by that local group to try to, you know, drum up support from the wider community. about it, which caused a bit of a social media crisis that lasted for a few days. So there, what English Heritage then did was try to engage. At some point, they got a little bit into too much detail in explaining why a particular building has value over another, and that, you know, extended the crisis a bit. So, you know, advice there is, look, get the facts out. Try to keep it short. Try not to get into detail. If there is something that you want to put out which is complicated, get away from social media. That's not the right medium for complicated messages. So issue a statement, a video, talking head, something of outside that media. So that's an example of well-intentioned groups. Misinformation, as I said, is different, and disinformation is different again. So there you need to be really cognizant that often these groups who are dealing with misinformation, like the anti-vaccination groups, are really, really well organized, and they have resources, and they have you know, the equivalent of media departments, sometimes you know, more professional than the local authority you deal with. So it's worth understanding that in those cases, you're dealing with a more professional outfit, and you need to be really careful about how you engage. Research has shown that often just coming back with facts and facts again doesn't work, because the reason those groups are pushing the message is not to do with the facts. It's to do with often a feeling of community, so they feel bonded by the message. They feel like the world is against them, and they are, if you like, fighting for their truth. So there's a certain point at which you need no longer to engage by trying to correct the messaging. You need instead to make sure your message is clear and out there in the media, in the public domain, and try to, if you like, stop continue engagement, because the engagement feeds the beast. The more you do it, the more the message actually serves those groups.
So I find the anti-vaxxing kind of phenomenon really both fascinating and horrifying. And we've had public health counselors with public health portfolios on the podcast before, who you know, were trying to. Actually, there was Melanie Hampton from Wandsworth was trying to organize a measles vaccination campaign just as we were going into lockdown, which was a great thing to do, but unfortunate timing in retrospect. But one of the things that I said to her was that, you know, I am a full proponent for vaccination. I think it's been one of the most amazing things that we've done as a, you know, as a species, is being able to protect ourselves from communicable diseases in this way. But, and my child's vaccinated, but I don't feel like I have a compelling emotional argument, you know, if I ever engage with anti-vaxxers. And I tend to just turn off or become sort of like angry or identify them as kooks. And I'm not talking in a professional capacity, but in my kind of, you know, personal online space, I might make fun of them, those kind of things. But really, they're threatening the health of all of us. And me just treating them as a kook is not an effective way of dealing with things. How can we as people who, you know, want to support the truth of vaccination or climate change or the, you know, a range of different either, you know, public health or critical policy issues. How can we engage with people who don't engage with facts? How can we arm people like myself in my personal capacity to make a convincing emotional argument?
That's a really great question. I would say one of the most underused tools at the disposal of experts or local authorities, public health experts, etc., is engagement with communities with lived experience. So vaccination has been a huge boon for our species, for our health. It saved millions and millions of lives. There is a point at which kind of arguing the facts of vaccination and against anti-vax groups by the doctors or the professors, the experts, as I said before, stops being effective. It's not the facts which are at issue, it's other things. So a tactic which is underused but very powerful is there are amazing groups of people who have stories to tell about how vaccination has helped their communities, how other, if you like, lived conditions they might have, medical conditions, have been helped. Those communities out there, they are well organized, they often have online presence. So one tactic is to engage with them and use their stories, their lived experience, as your rationale for why it's important. And this applies to many, many health cases, climate change, you know, stories, lived experience by people in, you know, Micronesia, Polynesia, in the Pacific Ocean, whose islands are being swamped by this, by the rising sea level, are more powerful in showing the reality of climate change than, you know, 100 press releases by top academics sometimes, because they have emotional resonance. So you need to understand it's the emotional resonance here that's important, in addition to getting the facts right. So I would say engagement with people with lived experience in whatever the controversy is, and using those stories is often an underused but effective technique.
So one of the things that I'm currently seeing right now, and this is not a UK issue, but this is very specific to the US, and being an American and we have an election coming up, is the level of fraud in postal voting and mail-in ballots. I've been a mail-in voter for years because I live in the UK. And I also work on elections every year, local elections, work with local authority election administrators year in, year out on local elections projects here. So I am both a voter who feels passionate about democracy, but also I am an expert, you know, I'm not the most expert, but I would, you know, I have some expertise in elections. And I find myself often, you know, resorting to my professional experience when I'm arguing with people who are saying, no, mail-in voting is full of fraud. So what you're saying is, no, I really need to like speak more about my passion for democracy, about my experience of working with local authority election administrators and what kind of people they are, and how they feel passionate about protecting the process, and that kind of thing.
So I would say you need both. So you definitely need to have the facts out there. That's the first starting point. But I would say in order to engage with people who are hard to reach with facts, you need also the emotional resonance. So both tactics at the same time. I would say personal stories work well. Also, the other point I would say is often, and this goes beyond social media, it's a more general point about community engagement. Often engaging at the point where the message is most like pressing, just before the election, is not the right time to engage, because that's when the emotion is at its highest. So I would say having campaigns of communication, outreach, true public engagement, where there's a dialogue, two-way dialogue, in the times before, when we're not having the election, is effective, because what you're doing there is you're building links with your communities. So outreach, if you like, in advance, can be useful as a way of convincing people, bringing them to your side, if you like, of the argument, rather than waiting until the moment is acute, the election is about to happen, and doing it then.
Yeah, that's good advice. I hope it works. Certainly, as people are trying to vote in a pandemic, it's just bringing a whole range of highly emotive and highly subject to misinformation kind of topics all together. So, fun times. What can councils do in terms of, you know, they're big bodies, they cover lots and lots of services, but in terms of like institutional fitness to deal with issues like this, what can we do to kind of like make ourselves more well equipped to deal with this? This isn't a problem that's going to go away. We're not going to solve it as a problem. We just need to solve it in each context.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not going to go away, I'm afraid. We live in a virtual world nowadays. I think it is important for local authorities to have kind of a breadth and depth of expertise, and often that doesn't mean hiring a PR company or social media kind of consultancy, but just having tapping into the skills of your staff. The younger generation than myself are new media and online natives. They have skills that, despite my experience, I will never have about how to use any said new social media channel, from TikTok to what have you, as the next big thing. So I would say have breadth of expertise and use expertise of your staff in your local authority. Understand the different channels and understand their peculiarities. So it's important to recognize that what works on Twitter will not work on Facebook, because channels have features which drive particular types of engagement. That's where you need the breadth of expertise, and that's where you need, if you like, your staff who use those platforms. The second thing I would say is, for messages which you know are likely to trigger misinformation or trigger controversy, have talking points. Prepare in advance the ground of what you want to get across. Often experts are human like everyone else. They make mistakes. One of the things I say in Welcome and other organizations is, if you like, prepare the ground before understand what message you want to get across, understand the medium and the platform, and craft the message for that platform. So definitely prepare in advance. You can probably predict also the time of when a controversy might arise. So you just mentioned elections. You know that certain things are time sensitive. So again, you can prepare the ground in advance for those. One of the things in social media crisis, so-called, that organizations find difficult to deal with is just the speed of communication in the eye of the storm, so to speak. So often experts like to take time to verify the facts and craft the message. And when Twitter, when you get, you know, tens of thousands of tweets per minute about a crisis, you don't have the time to craft the perfect response. So often you make a mistake. Or say something in a clunky way that then, you know, feeds the crisis further. So if you can predict certain sensitive areas, sort of topics, and also predict the time when they might arise because they're connected to an event, have those things prepared in advance, the talking points prepared. So when you need in that eye of the storm to have the message right, you have it already, rather than trying to kind of craft the perfect tweet with, you know, 5 seconds to spare. So these are basic things, but, you know, having the breadth of expertise, tapping into the staff who probably know these platforms better than you, having a slightly different plan for each platform, knowing its, strengths and weaknesses, and having talking points prepared for areas of controversy.
One final question, actually, around this is institutions themselves have been known to, without any bad intention, or maybe sometimes with, but without any bad intention, say, issue the wrong information, issue bad information, or issue information that later comes to light is wrong. So what's the best way to, like, because someone will exploit that and say you were wrong. What's the best way to deal with that?
This is another really great point and area of focus on in the past and the expert organizations I work in. Like I said before, I think experts are human. We will make mistakes, particularly on social media. We often drop our guard because, remember, when you are in front of your computer or phone at home, you feel in a not in your usual professional setting. So it's too easy to do a quick tweet response to something and get things wrong. But of course, the nature of the media is that will stay there forever. So that will be picked up by somebody. That will be amplified. That can cause a reaction. So things will occasionally go wrong. We need to prepare ourselves for it. I think if they do go wrong accidentally, the best advice I can give is be honest, admit it straight away that you did something wrong. Don't try to hide it because it's likely it'll come out. And if you like, prepare a response. So openness, transparency about making a mistake. One specific case that I've dealt with before is where experts in one area, if you like, stray beyond the area of expertise. So that's an important point about misinformation by experts inadvertently. We all have views about everything, political views, views about the current events, etc. If you are Professor X or Dr. X and you have a particular expertise in the title, people listen to you. So the temptation is to comment more broadly than perhaps you should. In the current COVID pandemic scenario, this has been a problem in the sense that there's been an oversupply of information. And often people who are great experts in their own fields, but are not epidemiologists, are commenting around things because they're human and they feel emotional, resonance with this really moment of crisis. But of course, their comments are interpreted as the expert said this or the expert said that because of who they are, and that can be quite problematic. So a lot of colleagues of mine who are epidemiologists, basically early on in the pandemic, said, "Look, please stop tweeting to their other colleagues in academia about this pandemic, because you might get the messaging slightly wrong, or you might misinterpret the model." So that's a specific case where experts themselves have to be careful on social media. Be clear on what you're expert at. So on my tweets, for example, I have a pinned tweet at the top of my Twitter, which says, I have expertise in this area, specifically studying misinformation, and this is why. So I give almost like a mini bio of what is my authority, what does it rest on? And I also, in tweets, when I give kind of examples outside of that area of expertise, I flag it. I say, look, speaking as a non-expert, I think X. But you need to clearly differentiate that from when you are trying to be the expert in a particular area.
That's very good advice that I should probably take myself. I'm always looking to expand my perceived area of expertise, and I need to take a step back. Thank you very much for discussion this morning. There's a lot to think about and a lot for councils to take away.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Oh, that's really fascinating.
And disturbing.
Yeah. But I think what I particularly enjoyed, I think, about that, if enjoyed isn't quite the right word, but he does move towards a sort of analysis of what we can do about this.
Yeah.
And how individuals, how counsellors, how people working in public services can actually start to communicate in ways that build towards truthfulness, set a foundation for more trusting relationships. And I found that really interesting because I feel quite clear on various aspects of this problem. Or I feel I sort of understand the problem a bit and I sort of can get it. But I'm much less certain about what you do about it, which is normal, right? You start with the problem and if it was easy to see how to fix problems, we wouldn't have them. But I think that's really helped. Yeah, I think that was interesting, but also helpful.
Yeah, and I think we can explore this theme further as well, because councils don't just have to counter misinformation around public health matters. There is bad information shared about candidates, about local issues, as he described. And we just have to shift our thinking about that. This isn't going to go away. We're not going to suddenly become a society where this doesn't happen. And it's not that
And we never were a society.
We never were. It's just that it can move a lot faster now. So just like councils had to embrace different communications channels, we're going to have to embrace different communication methods too.
Yeah, for sure. And I think also what's very clear from this is that there isn't a sort of a kind of magic solution to this. It's hard yards. It's bit by bit. It's just sort of, one kind of tackling it one bit at a time. There's no overall switch. You just have to do the hard digging of getting down into it and countering every little bit. And it's patience and building slowly. Okay, so lots going on, lots coming up over the next couple of weeks. What are the messages we want to leave people with, Ingrid? I have three.
You have three messages?
Yeah.
Wash your hands.
Oh, four messages. Wash your hands. But hit subscribe.
Yes, hit subscribe. We've got lots more great episodes coming your way. Some of the interviews are like already in the bag. I can guarantee you they're really good. So we're going to be looking at food security. We're going to be looking at tourism and recovery and much more over the next few months, following up on those post-COVID things.
That you don't want to miss any of that, so hit subscribe. While you're hitting subscribe, you can leave a review, so that will help other people to find the podcast. Message two: tell a friend.
Absolutely, if you like. That word of mouth is tremendous. It really makes a difference. Maybe not tell a friend, maybe tell a colleague. I'll admit this show has niche appeal.
I don't think that's true. I don't accept that. But part of our mission surely is to, because I think that's, in a sense, I mean, in all seriousness, part of the challenge we face in our sector is that local government is seen as a niche interest, when in fact local government is the web and weft of everyday life. It is the big life and death stuff that everybody cares about, whether our elderly relatives are looked after. Everybody cares about whether our kids have decent homes. Everyone cares about education. Everyone cares about clean, safe streets. Everyone cares about protecting vulnerable children. So this is the weird thing, is that interest in local government is niche. But the stuff that local government is interested in and the stuff that local government does is not niche. It's the stuff we all care most about. And kind of connecting across that, I think, is a really important part of what we need to do in the sector and at LGRU specifically.
Okay, tell a friend. Then tell a friend.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell all your friends.
Tell all your friends and family. But also, drop us a line. You can tweet us at LGRU. You can write to us at info@lgiu.org. And tell us what you want to hear on the shows as we go through summer and into autumn.
Absolutely. And then my final message, go to our website. You know, you'll find lots more on all of the issues that we have discussed today and many, many more. Yeah, amazing briefings, amazing insight, yeah, huge amounts of sort of analysis and intelligence across all the issues, all the non-niche issues that local government deals with and some of the niche ones as well. And while you're there on our website, what should you do, Ingrid?
You should nominate someone for the Councillor Awards.
You really, really, really should. So if you do nothing else, please do that.
Thanks for listening.
Goodbye.